The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Closing the Loop, How State and Local Transportation Officials Are Closely Trying to Find Solutions to the Complex Web of Road Expansions and Completions. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, The 540 Puzzle, The Growth and Economic Development Activity of Many Triangle Towns is Largely Dependent on Closing the 540 Loop. And this is written by Lauren Onasorge. The applause rippled through the crowd in April. Japanese pharmaceutical company Fujifilm Diosynth Biotechnologies was making an investment in its Holly Springs operation, part of a $1.2 billion expansion. This exciting investment will create one of the largest facilities in the world to perform cell culture manufacturing of bulk medicines, Governor Roy Cooper told the crowd. Just 34 minutes away in the Raleigh suburb of Knightdale, officials were celebrating too. That's because by the time the 680 high-paying jobs hit the Holly Springs operation, the site will be much closer for commuters in Knightdale, thanks to the long-planned Complete 540 project, and they hope to lure some of the new scientists to the suburb. The full loop could open to traffic in 2028, suddenly making the 34-minute trip between Holly Springs and Knightdale a lot faster. It certainly shortens those commutes, says Jason Brown, Development Services Director for the town of Knightdale. But with that accessibility may come even more traffic, as the toll road is expected to be able to accommodate 70,000 vehicles per day. And some of that traffic, thanks to that accessibility, may create log jams on side streets from Holly Springs to Knightdale. Towns have about 6 years to figure it all out. That says most say they're still in the planning phase, seeking out future bottlenecks and brainstorming how to fix them in time for Complete 540. Monumental effort. Complete 540, planned as a toll road, the fees for which will start being set later this year, is a monumental effort by all accounts, from the 4.3 million bricks being used for the wall supporting its bridges to the 800,000 tons of asphalt that required for just its first phase. Communities have been preparing for years, since long before the loop broke ground. Complete 540 will extend the Triangle Expressway from the Apex Holly Springs area to where the northern loop of I-540 ends in Knightdale. The project was recently awarded a loan worth up to $417 million from the U.S. Department of Transportation. Complete 540's second phase, an 11-mile, $1.3 billion effort, will break ground soon and will connect to Phase 1, a 17.1-mile project currently under construction. As of April, Phase 1 of the project is 95% complete, with contractors working to finish paving and installing the electronic tolling equipment over the next few months. If all goes well, it could open to traffic in July. Phase 2 preliminary activities have already started, with plans for more substantial construction activities to commence in May, according to the North Carolina Department of Transportation. The pending timeline is putting pressure on communities to ensure secondary roads can handle the increased traffic. We're already seeing some volumes on roads that are going to be exacerbated by 540, says Braston Newton, Johnston County Planning Director. The county recently teamed up with consultant McAdams to revamp its comprehensive transportation plan for the first time in a decade, a $200,000 contract that will identify potential trouble spots. Newton says the county is looking at 540 as an opportunity, but adds, we have to understand what those impacts are and what that looks like and how we're going to manage that growth. Similarly, in Knightdale, Brown says the town has completed an analysis that looks at interchanges of the I-87 corridor and what they might look like after 540. We found out on some roads the opening of 540 actually alleviates traffic, he says. Take the Knightdale roads, Hobbs and Bethlehem. Both could see volume reduced as cars would have an easy alternative in 540. But two of Knightdale's main roads, Poole and Smithfield, would likely get an influx. Brown says developers have to be a part of the conversation. He points to the Hodge Road corridor south of I-87, where the development community has been active in widening pavement to support their own projects. Knightdale, like Johnston County Communities, is working to help identify other projects that might be available for bonus allocation funds. It's also still working to identify potential bottlenecks that could occur when the full loop opens. We're feeling a lot more development pressure, Brown says, noting that developers big and small see opportunities from Complete 540. We're in the process of updating our comprehensive plan to help us answer those questions, he says. Holly Springs is also feeling the pressure as new interchanges could mean a major influx to the town. Having access to the interchanges is great, but how we move traffic to the interchanges is just as important, says Kendra Parrish, Executive Director of Utilities and Infrastructure for the town, which recently pulled the trigger on its largest road project yet, the Holly Springs Road Widening Project, the years-long $34 million effort, which has received $4 million in federal funds, is on track to be complete by the end of 2025. Parrish says 540's pending completion was really a driver in the project as they're adjacent to each other. So where DOT finishes the 540 improvements, we pick up and continue that four-lane widening, she explains. Otherwise, you'd have a two-lane road dumping into the interchange. And it's not done. The town, like Knightdale, is looking at land use options and engaging with the community on what's next. But funding is complicated. Chasing dollars. We're always trying to add improvements, trying to leverage as much as we can to get more improvements in there, Parrish says. There was not a lot we could add to Complete 540 because of the turnpike and the way it's funded, she says. And that's required creativity. With some NCDOT projects, there are dollars available to help bolster side streets, but Complete 540 is unique as a toll road. When the road opens, the tolls, expected to be comparable to the current Triangle Expressway, go toward paying back the bonds for the debt taken out to fund the $2.5 billion project. State statute dictates toll revenue has to be used on the toll road where it is collected. Excess toll revenue still has to be used within the corridor where the Turnpike project is located, the statute states. And that means most projects towns think are necessary to support what's coming have to compete for typical state funds or be funded locally. And the state funds are competitive. For example, Johnston County has submitted three projects for state dollars, highways that, according to Newton, will both support the influx from Complete 540 and a newly designated interstate. But state funds are never guaranteed, and since the pandemic, project costs have skyrocketed, making even projects deemed critical by communities across the state less of a sure thing. For its part, NCDOT says its project will include extras for the surrounding communities. In particular, the plan includes pedestrian and cyclist improvements, such as the addition of a multi-use path spanning the Bells Lake Road Bridge over the future toll road, as well as sidewalks and bike lanes added to the area surrounding the Holly Springs Road interchange. This project prioritizes regional mobility and has included or provided the opportunity for four crossing intersection improvements, improvements to existing U.S. 401 between the future toll NC 540 and 1010 Road, improvements to Sunset Lake Road, major improvements to Holly Springs Road, and the completion of the I-40 widening project, NCDOT spokesman Logan Hodges says. Regardless of how it plays out exactly, the communities in Complete 540's path know major changes are coming and putting plans in place now. As Knightdale's Brown says, it's a trade-off, but we've been preparing, trying to get ready for what those impacts might be and how to start the conversation with region partners. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by Managing Editor Dane Huffman. Changes coming to UNC campus. Changes coming to the Pit, an iconic location on the UNC Chapel Hill campus that dates to the 1960s. Until 1965, the UNC baseball team played at Emerson Field, which is now the heart of campus. But Carolina decided to put a bookstore and a student union there and move the baseball team further south to Beauchamer Stadium. The construction of the bookstore and student union left a big mud pit. The solution? brick it in with two trees in the middle. The pit, since then, has been a beloved part of campus with students streaming by, different groups setting up tables, and plenty of speakers trying to get attention. But the 60-year-old drainage pipes are failing, leaving the space a mess after rains, and fixing the pipes would kill the trees, which are nearing the end of their lives anyway. So Daniel Wittes, the university landscape architect, is leading a process to reimagine the space, and the issue with flooding is only part of the equation. The other overarching reason is coming out of COVID, everybody wants to be outside, and there's a real drive to activate outdoor spaces, he says. You can look at the pit as large outdoor real estate that isn't designed as effectively as it could be. Some of the design ideas include changing the brick steps to gentle slopes, putting a raised walkway through the middle, or even, gasp, bricking up the space and making it level. The gathering of ideas and feedback will wrap up in the coming weeks, and the move toward a more formal process could begin in the fall. As UNC heads into commencement ceremonies May 11, the incoming class of 2028 is expected to experience a pit that is a reimagined space in the center of campus. And it comes at a time when the adjacent student union, which dates to 1968, could be updated. Already, UNC is looking at how schools such as NC State University have made their student unions more vibrant and more aligned with the needs of students today. Wittes says the feedback so far has been positive despite the sentimental attachment to the pit. The space was probably doing less than what it could to meet the campus demands, he says. Indian culture coming to Morrisville. If you're around Church Street in Morrisville on May 11th, Biz is hearing thousands are expected to embark at the Indian Punjabi Mela, held at the cricket ground of the town. We're expecting about 2,000 people at the event, which is a celebration of food, culture, and success, says Harinder Dinza, owner of Swagat Restaurant on Chapel Hill Road in Morrisville, who also is one of the lead sponsors of the event. Dinza says it costs about $150,000 to put together a free event like the Punjabi Mela, and it has become a favorite among the Indian community across the state. I hope the entire Triangle community will come and experience the vibrancy of the festival, he says. The festival runs from noon to 8 p.m. As of last year, according to the town of Morrisville, the town's population is a little more than 32,000. People from India or other Southeast Asian countries make up 36% of the Morrisville population. Historic hotel opens in New Bern. New Bern, with its historic homes and river views, makes for a great getaway from the Triangle, and now a new hotel is looking to capture interest in visiting the city. Charles Cushman, CEO of Heron Hospitality, upfitted a building that dates to 1797 and named it the Harvey. The 10-room hotel opened May 10 at 221 South Front Street. The building was originally constructed for ship merchant John Harvey. Everyone in this town has a memory of the Harvey, Cushman says. It really is one of the defining buildings of downtown New Bern. Everyone has a story with it, and I think everyone is just super excited to see it be reborn. You just won the Open. You get the trophy for a year. While it's not quite the Stanley Cup, the U.S. Open trophy has a storied history in its own right. The Gorham Corporation created the original trophy back in 1895 and presented it to the U.S. Golf Association. Every Open winner got to keep the trophy for a year before returning it before the next Open. That all went fine until 1946. The Open was played that year for the first time since 1941 and won by Lloyd Mangrum, who served in World War II and was wounded twice. Mangrum kept the trophy at the Tam O'Shanter Golf Course outside Chicago, but the club burned and the trophy was lost in September 1946. The USGA replaced it with an exact replica, and that one went home with the winner until 1986. At that point, the USGA put the trophy in its museum and had another replica, the third one, made for the winner. After the winner keeps it for a year and he returns it, it is now given a smaller version. And finally, tax rates to change in Wake. The soaring property values in Wake County are having a big impact on county tax rates. Wake County on May 6 revealed the proposed tax rate for the 2024-25 fiscal year, a more than 20% cut from 65.7 cents to 51.05 cents per $100 of valuation. The new rate comes after the 2024 property revaluations released in January showed an overall increase of 53% from 4 years ago for the more than 400,000 residential properties covered. So even with the significant cut in the tax rate, many homeowners in Wake County will see their property taxes increase this year. Based on a revenue-neutral tax rate, whether a homeowner pays more or less in taxes depends on the change in their individual property value compared to the overall change for the county. Under the proposed rate, a resident who owns a $462,000 home, roughly the median assessed value in Wake County, will receive a tax bill of $2,358 this year, the county said in a press release. The county is preparing a $2 billion budget for the upcoming fiscal year. When the property revaluations were released in January, the county at the time said it was estimating a tax rate of more than 46 cents per $100 of valuation. And now we turn to the top news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one written by Kaylee Thompson, $200 million revamp of Durham bottling plant moves forward. The $200 million redevelopment of a bottling facility in northwest Durham is moving forward. Ardent Companies of Atlanta recently filed site plans for its redevelopment of the Durham Coca-Cola Bottling Company warehouse. The new development will have 370 apartments, 35 townhomes, and nearly 70,000 square feet of retail space, including a grocery store. The company had the property rezoned in October. Jay Douglas, executive director for Ardent Companies, says the company is anticipating closing on the land by the end of this year so it can break ground in the first quarter of 2025. If it follows that timeline, the development will open in the third quarter of 2026. The timeline is dependent on when Coca-Cola finishes building its new facility in Chatham County, which Douglas says is on track to be complete by the end of this year. The multifamily units will be a mix of studio, 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms, and a 7-story building that will wrap a parking deck with 520 parking spaces. The company hasn't settled on how many bedrooms the townhomes will have, but 5 of them will be offered at 80% of the area median income. All of the townhomes will be for sale. Amenities include a swimming pool, courtyard, outdoor grilling areas, and interior amenities that have yet to be decided. Retail will be in 6 buildings, 1 for the grocer and 5 for new retailers. The grocery space will be 23,291 square feet, and the remaining buildings will hold about 15 retailers. Douglas says Ardent wants to create a Class A service and family-oriented retail that meet the daily needs of the local community. That includes retail options like fitness and food and beverage concepts. The bottling facility will be demolished, but the company will reuse pieces of it in the new development. Douglas says the company hasn't yet had a chance to evaluate what will be left behind by Coca-Cola Bottling Company. The only building that will remain is the First Citizens Bank branch. The Durham Coca-Cola bottling facility is at 3214 Hillsborough Road. The more than 100,000 square foot warehouse is on 11 acres. The property's assessed value is about $4.5 million. The headquarters facility was built in 1961 to distribute Coca-Cola products in Durham, Person, Granville, and Vance counties, and parts of Wake, Orange, and Chatham counties. The company is consolidating its Durham and Sanford locations and moving the headquarters to Chatham County. Canadian franchise targets the Triangle. Tim Hortons plans to enter North Carolina, looks for franchisees, and this article is written by Ben Tobin. A restaurant chain known for being loved by Canadians is eyeing North Carolina and the Triangle specifically for expansion. Tim Hortons, the multinational coffee house and restaurant chain, could soon be planning to open its first North Carolina locations. William Washington, the head of real estate for Restaurant Brands International, the Toronto fast food holding company that owns Tim Hortons, Burger King, Popeyes, and Firehouse Subs, says the company is looking to bring Tim Hortons to the Triangle area and that we are recruiting new franchisees. Washington declines to do an interview, and he and the other representatives of Tim Hortons did not respond to follow-up questions regarding where and when stores will open, how many there will be in North Carolina, and what the company finds attractive about the Triangle area. Founded in 1964 in Hamilton, Ontario, Tim Hortons has close to 6,000 restaurants across over a dozen countries, including Canada, the United States, Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. In the United States, Tim Hortons has hundreds of stores spread across 11 states, with the closest ones to the triangle being in Georgia. The company, which is the biggest quick service chain in Canada and saw sales of $2.73 billion in 2023, is aggressively trying to expand its United States presence. The company said earlier this year that it plans to have 1,000 stores in the United States by 2028. At the end of 2023, the Philadelphia Business Journal reported that Tim Hortons signed a multi-unit deal to place its first stores in Delaware. Ryan Ferranti, head of business development for Tim Hortons U.S., told Franchise Times in December that the company will look next to expand into Arizona, the Carolinas, and California sometime in the next 5 years. Tim Hortons isn't the only chain drawn to North Carolina by the region's rapid growth. Convenience store chain Wawa announced in October that it's planning to place dozens of stores in North Carolina in the near future, with the first 8 stores concentrated in eastern North Carolina. And Buc-ee's, the Texas chain of oversized convenience stores, is moving forward with its first North Carolina location off Interstate 85 in Mebane. And now we have a story written by Lauren Onisorge. Hotels accused of using SaaS tech to fix prices. A group of plaintiffs in California is accusing major hotel companies of using SaaS technology to fix room rate prices in violation of antitrust laws. The class action lawsuit targets SaaS, along with major hotel operators including Hilton Worldwide Holdings, Four Seasons Hotels and Resorts, Omni Hotels and Resorts, Hyatt Hotel Corporation, Wyndham Hotels and Resorts, and Choice Hotels International. The lawsuit alleges that rather than competing on price, the hoteliers are fixing their rates through a shared pricing algorithm. The hotels input a continuous stream of non-public, competitively sensitive price and occupancy information in real time, according to the lawsuit. The information is used by the algorithm to generate supra-competitive pricing recommendations. Every business person knows that the only way a company can consistently raise prices above the competitive rate is if its horizontal competitors also agree to raise their prices above the competitive level, the lawsuit says, comparing it to a backroom information exchange. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal, starting with Lauren Onisorge's page on tech and startups. Raleigh startup wins IdeaFest prize. Mass Refund helps immigrants handle their tax preparations. Mass Refund, a Raleigh startup targeting Hispanic immigrants, is building up its coffers one entrepreneurship contest at a time, and that's spelled M-A-S, Refund, R-E-F-U-N-D. This month, the tax tech company walked away with the top prize of $5,000 at the IdeaFest pitch competition. Simon Kamarkar, who founded Mass Refund in the midst of the pandemic, says the idea struck him while he was working at H&R Block. He observed Spanish-speaking customers coming in and not enough staff who spoke their language. Kamarkar realized most of the questions asked by tax preparers followed an easy formula. If you're single, then this. If you're married, then this. So he wrote a rudimentary code, and it worked. In the midst of COVID shutdowns in 2020, he quit his job at H&R and went all in on his idea, helped by a supportive wife. And through the research he was doing for the startup that became Mass Refund, he realized it wasn't just about Spanish-speaking Americans, it was the immigrant story, something he could relate to as his father moved his family to the U.S. in the 1970s. The biggest thing he was worried about was making a mistake on his taxes and all of us being deported, Kamarkar says of his father. Kamarkar interviewed immigrants from all over, with many expressing some of those same fears, but there was another commonality that he said surprised him. After they submitted their tax returns, they felt like they were part of the American fabric, he says. The opportunity for a company like Mass Refund was bigger than he had anticipated, Kamarkar says. We have to democratize access to knowledge. That became my personal rallying call to develop this app, he says. Disney investment fuels new jobs. Nearly 3 months after the Walt Disney Company disclosed plans to invest $1.5 billion in Epic Games, the partnership is creating jobs in Cary. In February, Disney announced it would invest in the Cary video game developer behind Fortnite, part of a collaboration of an all new games and entertainment universe that will further expand the reach of beloved Disney stories and experiences. According to listings on Epic's own hiring website, the company is looking for experienced video game personnel to take on key roles in facilitating the partnership. A sweep of the firm's jobs page shows 7 positions that mention Disney and are based in Cary, from concept artists to gameplay programmers and animators. A listing for a lead concept artist, for example, says that Epic is looking for someone to help build several initiatives as part of our collaboration with Disney. And finally, North Carolina Theater lobbies for state funds. As the North Carolina Theater in Raleigh tries to recover from bankruptcy, lobbying efforts with the North Carolina General Assembly are in full force. The theater suspended its season after filing for bankruptcy earlier this year. It still operates classes and camps through its conservatory. For March, it operated those programs at a cash loss, waiting on a certain grant funds, according to a status report in the bankruptcy case. But more money could be coming as state lawmakers return. John Zaloom, the theater's board chair, says the organization is working with its lobbyists to set up meetings with legislators over this week and next. And now we turn to Zach Ezone's page on healthcare and higher ed. WakeMed ramps up Cary Surgery Center, focused on surgery as part of a growing trend in healthcare. WakeMed recently opened a new surgery center in Cary, and the healthcare system is looking for surgeons to buy in. WakeMed Surgery Center Cary opened about 4 months ago on the 5th floor of a medical office building on Asheville Avenue near the WakeMed Cary Hospital. The roughly 14,500 square foot site has 4 surgical units, including 1 operating room and 3 procedure rooms. WakeMed began planning the center a few years ago and received approval for a Certificate of Need, or CON, from state regulators in August 2019, says Tom Hughes, Senior Vice President and Administrator at WakeMed Cary Hospital. According to a budget WakeMed submitted to regulators as part of the CON process, the facility was projected to have a capital cost of about $8.6 million. There are about 20 surgeons credentialed at the facility, covering areas such as general surgery, urology and obstetrics, and gynecology. The center will likely credential more surgeons as it finalizes contracts with insurers, some of which are already complete. WakeMed is giving the surgeons the opportunity to invest in the facility through a separate legal entity, WakeMed Surgery Center Cary LLC. This entity on April 23rd filed paperwork with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission to open a roughly $2.2 million equity offering with a minimum investment of $11,143. The offering amount represents a minority share of the center, with WakeMed remaining the majority owner. Hughes, who signed the SEC filing, says WakeMed plans to meet with surgeons until the offering closes near the end of June. Both private surgeons and those employed by WakeMed can invest in the center as long as they meet certain requirements. The surgeons must be credentialed at the center, and they must perform a third of eligible surgeries at the facility. Physicians who invest in the center can benefit by getting their patients in sooner. Additionally, this approach can support the financial viability of private physicians. And for WakeMed, having physicians invest in the success of the center helps preserve patient volume within the health system. It's a good way to really align the interest of the health system, surgeons, so that we can ensure access to good, low-cost care, Hughes says. Global firm picks Triangle over Boston, Philly for 170 jobs. A European life sciences company is establishing operations in Mooresville with plans to fill more than 100 positions. Solvias, that's spelled S-O-L-V-I-A-S, is building out a 50,000-square-foot facility that will expand its analytical testing services for companies developing cell and gene therapies and other biologics. Solvias operates as a contract research organization with a focus on chemistry, manufacturing, and control analysis for biotechnology and pharmaceutical organizations. The company is moving into Discovery at Perimeter Park, a business park with 5 buildings for office and lab space on McCrimmon Parkway. It's owned by Longfellow Real Estate Partners. Solvias will initially occupy 20,000 square foot of the site, which has 30,000 square feet of shell space to be built out. Steve Smith, general manager of U.S. operations, says Solvias will occupy the first phase of the site by the end of the year and begin working with customers in the first half of 2025. It will complete the second phase of the build-out by summer next year, When it opens, the site will serve as the company's North American hub for its large molecule analytical services and related testing services. The facility will eventually have more than 170 employees. This process could take a few years, depending on the construction schedule and business demands. And finally, drug maker encouraged by new results. A small biopharmaceutical company in Chapel Hill plans to move one of its clinical programs to a Phase 3 trial following positive study results. Renovion is advancing a nebulized therapy called Arena 1 in multiple clinical programs focused on pulmonary diseases. The company, which originally licensed this technology from UNC Chapel Hill, last year raised $15 million to support these efforts. One of the clinical program's targets, non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis, a chronic lung condition with no approved treatments that directly targets mucus symptoms, Renovion hopes to develop the first approved treatment. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Kaylee Thompson. Iconic Holiday Inn to survive. For now, New York developers plan to build a Kimpton in its place. The Holiday Inn Hotel in downtown Raleigh won't be demolished anytime soon, with its new owners set to evaluate options later this year. In November 2021, Tidal Real Estate Partners purchased the lot at 300 Hillsborough Street and the neighboring parking lot at 320 Hillsborough Street for a combined $23.8 million. The company unveiled plans in early 2022 for a 20-story tower featuring a hotel, apartments, a parking deck, and restaurant and retail space, which it received approval for in July 2023. Tidal Real Estate, based on West 27th Street in New York City, later reached a deal to bring the first Kimpton Hotel to Raleigh. But Damian Cortez, the general manager at the hotel, says there is no decision yet on the future of the hotel. The owners of the property, it's up to them, he says. Cortez says the owners will meet in October and decide whether to renovate the property or close it. We don't know yet, he says. The coin is still spinning. We don't know if it will be heads or tails. Tidal Real Estate's projects page on its website lists 2026 next to the project. Whether that's a projected construction start or opening date is unclear, as Tidal did not respond to requests for comment. As of July, Tidal Real Estate Partners said there was no firm timeline for the demolition phase. No demolition permits have been applied for, according to the City of Raleigh's permit portal. The portal shows the project is in the review process for site-related permits. One of those permits is the application for a new commercial building. Cortez says the hotel is taking reservations through the end of the year. He says the hotel is about 80 to 90% booked on Fridays through Sundays and about 50% booked during the week. It's convenient to everything, he says. Cortez adds he has a staff of about six people who work the front desk and aid in housekeeping. The hotel's restaurant, Sky Tower Restaurant and Bar on the 20th floor, has been closed since 2019, but the hotel renewed its beer wine license with the city on April 16 for 1 year, indicating it could be getting ready to reopen. The 20-story structure with 203 guest rooms was built in 1969. New owners to upgrade Marriott and RTP. A hotel on the edge of Research Triangle Park has been sold to a Florida investment firm after the property was given back to the lender last year. The Marriott Raleigh-Durham Research Triangle Park, one of the Triangle's largest hotels, was acquired by Driftwood Capital for $21.44 million, according to Durham County deed records. The company, based in Coral Gables, says it plans to invest $9 million in renovations to the property. In July, Ashford Hospitality announced it would be returning 20 hotels to a lender after choosing not to pay down a maturing loan. The Marriott and RTP went back to the lender in November, according to property records, and was sold to Stonebridge Companies of Denver in December for $17.39 million. The recent sale to Driftwood nets Stonebridge a $4 million return. And finally, massive Apex Development expects to go vertical early next year. A massive master planned community in Apex is getting ready to break ground. RXR, the New York developers behind a $3 billion mixed-use project called Veridia, that's spelled V-E-R-I, DEA, will start site and infrastructure work this fall with plans to go vertical with the first buildings in early 2025. But plans for Phase 1 have changed slightly as the developer adjusts to the shifting commercial real estate market. Rebecca D'Aloia, Executive Vice President and Development Project Executive for RXR, says the first buildings to go up will be the multifamily with ground floor retail. Following that will be industrial space with 213,000 square feet in the first phase. Veradia will cover 1,200 acres along NC Highway 55. When complete, it will have 8,000 residential units, 3.5 million square feet of retail, hospitality and civic space, 12 million square feet of commercial space, and public open space and walking trails. And our last reporter page is written by Ben Tobin on Greater Triangle Growth. NYC window maker picks Selma for jobs. Firm from Queens could add 500 jobs in $96 million investment. A door and window manufacturer based in New York is set to build a new manufacturing plant in Johnston County that will create hundreds of jobs. Crystal Window and Door Systems, based in Queens in New York City, is investing $96 million to create a window and door manufacturing facility in Selma, a move that will create roughly 500 jobs with an average minimum wage north of $56,000. The new facility will be located in Eastfield Crossing, a 3 million square foot mixed-use development led by Kevin Doherty's Adventure Development. The project was officially announced May 2nd during a meeting of the state's Economic Investment Committee, which approved state incentives totaling more than $5.5 million over 12 years. The Selma plant will specialize in window fabrication, with the jobs expected to be created between 2025 and 2029. Founded in 1990 by Taiwanese immigrant Thomas Chen, Crystal Window and Door Systems has been expanding its reach in the United States. Last month, the company announced it would construct an advanced manufacturing facility and regional corporate headquarters in Texas, an investment totaling more than $121 million and 504 jobs. The company currently has five sites across the country, totaling more than 1 million square feet of manufacturing space. It is now targeting the growing market in the Southeast. Crystal is now a national manufacturer with five major production facilities across the country, Chen said in a news release following the Texas announcement. Our products are used in some of the most notable buildings throughout the nation. Other Crystal Window and Door Systems facilities are located in Chicago, St. Louis, Benton, Pennsylvania, and Riverside, California. The investment is a major win for Selma, a town with just over 6,800 residents where more than 27% live in poverty, according to estimates from the U.S. Census Bureau. Local leaders say Eastfield Crossing can serve as a boon to Selma's economy by attracting big companies. Dollar General developer buys land in Selma. A developer behind hundreds of Dollar General stores nationwide is buying even more land in Johnston County. An LLC tied to Capital Growth Buchalter, a developer based in Birmingham, Alabama, bought a 1.29-acre tract in Selma off the intersection of Interstate 95 and JR Road for just under $2 million earlier in April, according to Johnston County deed records. The previous owner of the land, Zippy Express LLC, purchased it for $2.85 million in July 2012, marking a rare case in which land in the county sold for less than its previous price. The site includes restaurant Fry Daddy Selma, which opened in 2021 and is known for its southern cooking. Capital Growth Buchalter did not return requests seeking comment. According to its website, it has developed residential and commercial real estate projects, including approximately 800 Dollar General stores. And finally, investor grabs property in Southern Pines. A Johnston County real estate investor has purchased commercial buildings in Moore County in a growing corridor. An LLC tied to Tillman and Company of Benson recently purchased a roughly one-acre tract off Morganton Road in the town of Southern Pines for more than $4.35 million, according to Moore County deed records. The property holds a Walgreens store and a dentist office. Johnson Tillman of Tillman and Company says his company bought the land as part of a 1031 exchange, which allows real estate investors to defer capital gains taxes. We sold some property in Fuquay-Varina and we're looking to satisfy a 1031 exchange, he says, adding the area's dynamic growth was a key selling point for the deal. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, USGA CEO Others Understand the Value of Pinehurst. Golf is big business. Golf's economic impact, direct and indirect, in the U.S. topped $226 billion in 2022, according to the American Golf Industry Coalition, or AGIC. Also, according to the same study, alternative forms of golf, such as Top Golf and Drive Shack and other golf entertainment venues, are pushing the game's overall participant base past 41 million per AGIC data, with more women and people of color playing and working the game than any time in history. So when I sat down with Mike Wan, CEO of the United States Golf Association, to talk about the state of golf and what it means to North Carolina, he was borderline euphoric. The real state of golf is 13 million more people in America play in this game than there were 5 years ago, and we're over 50% bigger than we were 10 years ago, Juan says. And in that growth, which is amazing to think about, in the last 10 years, we've gone 54% primarily driven by juniors, women, and people of color. Nobody would have guessed that 10 years ago. Now, Taiwan's optimism, with a well-known name in banking, longtime former executive vice president of First Citizens Bank, Jim Hyler. Hyler is now head of competition and rules at the Masters in Augusta, Georgia. Hyler also happens to be a former two-term president of the USGA. From Duke Energy to First Union and from Bank of America to Progress Energy, everyone stepped up to support our efforts to host the first U.S. Men's Open in Pinehurst, Hyler recalls of that 1999 event. Without that corporate support, not sure what you see today at Pinehurst would have been possible. In all, Hyler recalls more than $10 million of corporate tent sales were sold in 1999. I may be off by a little bit, but not much, he says. Clearly, the USGA is well aware of the corporate support and the willingness of the state of North Carolina and Moore County to put their best foot forward for the USGA and the Gulf Nation. So the USGA is now reciprocating by building the Golf House Pinehurst and supporting the relocation of the World Golf Hall of Fame. But Juan went further. I definitely see a migration from New Jersey to Pinehurst, he says of the USGA's headquarters in New Jersey. Whether the whole thing would be down here in time, I don't know. But we have more than 65 employees now in Pinehurst. The next time we play the U.S. Open, we will have more. In total, the USGA employs about 310 full-time staffers and has an annual budget of almost $210 million. Almost 70% of its revenue comes from hosting the U.S. Open, with the primary dollar intake coming from the television contract with NBC Comcast. If one talks to the owner of the sprawling 900-acre Pinehurst Resort, Robert H. Dedman and his family, and resort president Tom Pashley, Pinehurst, Moore County, and North Carolina may get a far bigger economic development jolt than originally thought. The USGA, U.S. Open, and Pinehurst fit together, USGA President Fred Perpall says. Pashley noted from here on, for the next 20-odd years, the Pinehurst Resort will hold some USGA event every 3 years. Juan noted Pinehurst is a permanent fixture when it comes to big golf. Maybe that's why the fabled number two course is now known as the anchor site. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read through some of the big numbers that are sprinkled throughout the this edition. The first big number is 19, where North Carolina, yikes, ranked in a recent U.S. News and World Report ranking of the best states. Utah was number one. Hurting North Carolina was the ranking of number 31 in infrastructure, including number 31 for internet access and number 24 for healthcare. $20 million. Nearly 2 years after launching, that's how much Front Porch Venture Partners has closed on in its second fund. Capital it's already putting to work to support innovation. And our next big number is $400 million. BioCryst Pharmaceuticals' new revenue guidance for 2024 after a first quarter that exceeded the company's expectations. BioCryst is focused on the commercialization of its lead product, Orladeyo, which the company believes could reach $1 billion in global revenue. $3 million. That's how much homes will start at in a new gated community in North Raleigh on the edge of Falls Lake. Sanctuary at Falls Lake will have 28 custom homes. And our last big number is $2.2 million. The amount ARD Trucking, headquartered in Timmonsville, South Carolina, recently paid for roughly 23 acres off U.S. 301 North and Womble Brooks Road East in Wilson. And now we turn to the quotable sections that are sprinkled throughout also. The first quote is from Julie Sue, interim U.S. Labor Secretary, after the Department of Labor reported 175,000 jobs were added in April, below the 240,000 economists had expected. I would say overall that these numbers continue to prove month after month that we continue to invest in America and invest in America's workers. And next, we have Raleigh investment firm Shaw Capital, led by Himanshu Shah, on its demand for changes at the vaccine developer Novavax. It has become clear to us that the board is content to maintain the status quo while stockholders continue to suffer under the company's declining stock price. Next is Nick Leverett, director of market analytics, co-star on Triangle's Apartment Outlook. I think vacancy will peak this year and then plateau or be flat for 6 months or a year and then start declining again as we get out of this wave of new inventory. And finally, we have Nick Sakanikis, a regional manager for Adams Homes, on an expanding neighborhood in Garner. Not only is Annandale just a hop off Interstate 40 into Raleigh, but it also offers some of the best schools in Johnston County, is close to shopping, and offers top shelf amenities. And now we'll return to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the guest column written by John Hood, who is a John Locke Foundation board member in Raleigh. The headline, Universities Should Cultivate Civic Leaders. Most students and their families invest time, effort, and resources into higher education for vocational reasons. They expect the knowledge, skills, and relationships acquired at a college or university will lead to good jobs. Like it or not, this is a fact. Before the middle of the 20th century, colleges and universities were elite institutions experienced by only a tiny share of the population and funded primarily by tuition and private gifts. Even then, most graduates weren't just there to read Plato, study fine art, or master quadratic equations for their own sake. They were being prepared for leadership roles in law, medicine, religion, commerce, or civic affairs. The GI Bill of Rights and the contemporaneous expansion of state universities in access and funding greatly expanded higher education scope. Now, more than a third of Americans have four-year degrees, and nearly half possess at least an associate's degree or post-secondary credential. I write often about the productivity of higher education and make no apologies for focusing primarily on the financial costs and benefits. That's what concerns most prospective students and their families, but my own concerns are broader than that. I believe in the intrinsic worth of expanding one's mind, of pursuing the true, the beautiful, and the good. I think all university students should, for example, study a core curriculum in the liberal arts. I also believe state institutions, such as the University of North Carolina, should continue to fulfill one of their original functions, cultivating leaders. In the past, only a small, unrepresentative elite could aspire to leadership roles. Thank goodness that's no longer the case. Still, most who lead businesses, governments, nonprofits, churches, and other organizations are college or university graduates. Quite apart from teaching specific disciplines or professional skills, campuses should prepare their graduates for leadership roles in their communities. That's one reason the UNC system is implementing a new requirement that graduates complete courses that, among other elements, study six key documents: the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the Federalist Papers, the Gettysburg Address, the Emancipation Proclamation, and Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham Jail. Of course, all voters ought to be taught the fundamentals of American government. That's why we have civics requirements in high school. The justification for doing more at the university level is that future leaders, by which I mean not just future politicians, activists, and public administrators, but the broader swath of community leaders who participate in and shape the public conversation, need a deeper dive into these foundational texts. Similarly, the new School of Civic Life and Leadership at UNC Chapel Hill will offer students the opportunity to develop the virtues and skills they need to practice prudent, effective leadership. They are the kind of citizens, in other words, who can lead North Carolina to a brighter future. Good for UNC and for us. And now we turn to the Executive Voice question and answer column. This one is on Paul Zarian. The headline, Relationships Key for Hines Leader. Paul Zarian found at an early age that he had a keen interest in commercial real estate. This is the interview is by Kaylee Thompson. And in a closer look section along with this article, title, Managing Director, age 36, family, wife Casey, three children, education, bachelor's degree, economics, Duke University, MBA, University of Pennsylvania, first job, lifeguard at 16. Paul Zarian could have been a doctor, but he realized during his pre-med days at Duke University that what he was truly passionate about was real estate. His parents were not in the real estate business, but growing up, it always fascinated him, leading him to drive around just to look at different developments. He found himself particularly drawn to historic downtown spaces. I like those types of authentic environments where the uses function really well together. They're active, they're vibrant, they're programmed. Those are the types of places where you want to spend your time, Zarian says. And as a developer, you're just trying to live up to that standard. That led him back to business school, and he landed at Hines in Atlanta. 3 years later, he brought Hines to the Triangle when the Houston-based development company started Fenton and decided to open an office here. What is the key to making a mixed-use development a success? In a mixed-use project, you're constantly having to make sacrifices for the unique components, but you do so in a way that makes the overall project better. For example, you try a challenging retail lease because it brings the right retailers in the project, or you design the floor plates differently to optimize for a certain use. But the beauty of mixed use is that if you can do that and you can make the best sacrifices in the right ways, you end up with a project that stands alone and functions on a unique basis, and you've achieved synergies between the different products that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to achieve. The other component to that is having alignment with your partners, whether that's with the municipality, with your investors, with other development partners. Like many other things, when parties are aligned in terms of the goals of what you want to achieve and you get everyone working together in the same fashion, you're able to work through any issues that inevitably come up, and they always do. What's on tap for Hines in 2024? We're continuing to execute on the projects we have. We have four investments in the Triangle. One is Fenton. We delivered the first phase 2 years ago and are finishing up the lease-up process across the office, multifamily, and retail product types. We acquired Waverly Place 2 years ago and are going through a rezoning to be able to add residential density along with a few new restaurants and transform a single-use asset into mixed-use. At American Tobacco in Durham, we're working to get that project started and accomplish some pre-leasing there. At the IBM 500 campus, IBM is occupying the campus, and there's some time left before that site is redeveloped. We're looking to continue to grow, and that's finding opportunities where we can add value. We love projects that have a placemaking component to them, and that can occur in a number of different ways, but we're always attracted to that kind of placemaking and social programming element. Elsewhere in North Carolina, we just acquired our first build-to-rent property. We do think that will become a larger part of what we do nationally going forward. What are retail tenants seeking in a new space or area? There are a few factors. The first is that they need to find a location where they can serve their customer. They know that better than any of us in the real estate business. They're constantly running analytics on where their customers are coming from. Then they're also looking for the right environment. Using Fenton as an example, this project is across the street from the former Carey Town Center, and you have to keep in mind retail failed in that location. The bet behind Fenton wasn't that it was a bad location for retail, but it was that the format of what retailers preferred was different than what existed previously. In addition to that, once they start focusing on a specific project, there are a lot of considerations that go into exactly where they want to locate, Visibility, size of the space, and access to parking is important. A lot of those fundamentals haven't changed. What has changed, though, is how the retail mix has changed over the years. 20 years ago, if you were starting a retail project, it would be led by department store anchors. That environment is very different now. Food and beverage is a much more important driver than it was, and so is entertainment. What's your advice for someone looking to get into commercial real estate? Real estate is such a people business, and the relationships that you build in real estate are often what matter most. Never lose sight of that. Always try to maintain your credibility and do what it takes to build trust. Without that, there isn't much else. It's focused on building relationships, it's networking, and it requires a lot of time, a lot of energy, and you have to really work at it. But again, if you do it the right way, it'll be something that benefits you your entire life. The other component to that is, right now, market conditions are challenging. Things are difficult. It's a challenge to capitalize projects. It's a challenge to make new projects work. But at the same time, it's environments like these that allow you to stand out. 2 or 3 years ago, when the market was hot, everything became commoditized. But now, if you can lean into your relationships, become creative, solve problems, then it's times like these where you can add value. And now in the small business section, we'll read the family business column written by James Lee, who is a family business speaker, advisor, and author. The headline, These Phrases Can Lead to Trouble in Business. How about a few words of wisdom and some phrases that can lead to trouble for a family business? It seemed like a good idea at the time. How often have you said that after a plan you were excited about ended up in a smoldering heap? Maybe a trial run or a little long overdue analysis revealed big problems with the budget, the time frame, the resource requirements, and the marketing challenges. Or maybe when you looked at it in the clear light of day, the plan didn't fit with the way your company does business. And a business with an eye for innovation might get revved up about a more efficient way to do its work. Sometimes it finds itself way down the road before realizing this just isn't going to fly. While it's important to look to improve, it's also important to avoid pouring resources into an idea that hasn't been thought out. If we don't make a big deal of the problem, it'll go away. Oh, don't you wish. I've known families with traditions of never getting difficult subjects up on the table. From a serious decline in sales to Uncle Wally's drinking, it was hear no evil, see no evil, in the naive hope that the elephant in the room would just sit quietly in the corner. But a minor illness left untreated can become critical. Think of a rusty nail in a bare foot. The problem keeps getting worse. Take a deep breath and start thinking and talking. What could possibly go wrong? SWOT is a planning exercise that can help answer that question as a company assesses its strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. SWOT can provide encouraging data on strategic possibilities, but by illuminating weaknesses and threats, a SWOT analysis can also provide an eye-opening look at what could go wrong and how to stay safe. Okay, so we don't know much about it. How hard could it be? This kind of talk lacks awareness of the time and effort required to get a brand new anything off the ground. Take my word for it, it's hard even when you know something about it. Starting a business from scratch, launching a new line of products, breaking into a new product, new market, or stepping up to full responsibility for leading your family's company takes a great deal of skill and commitment. The words of wisdom in such situations are, I've got a lot to learn, and I could use some help learning it. And we'll have to stop right there, but the last two statements are, maybe they'll pay us next month. And we haven't talked about him taking over the business, but he'll go along. And we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.